listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Anna Deavere Smith is an actor, writer, teacher, and a theatrical innovator, one of the creators of documentary theater, which she uses to explore complex social issues. Her latest work, Notes from the Field, deals with the relationship of education and incarceration. It's at the Second Stage Theater on that 305 West 43rd Street until December 11th, and I'm pleased that she was able to join us again on this show. Welcome back.
Thank you so much.
I read an interview where you were asked what made for a great interview, and your answer was, the interviewee. Well, as you can imagine, that took considerable weight off of me. What makes an interviewee great?
Well, I think it's probably different for different media. Like for you, what would be a great interviewee is probably very different from me. For me, it's somebody who uses language in a compelling way, and that doesn't have anything to do with education or anything like that. You know, I just think certain people have a really extraordinary facility for actually speaking and moving, and what I need is a person who has a very strong will to communicate about whatever the matter is, and then that, you know, they're going to end up on stage to be performed. So I think that's different than if you were bringing in someone to talk about, you know, the election that just happened.
Although I do want a lively interviewee as well, and the better guests are the ones who give me good answers and surprise me, and I'm sure that those surprises you see as little gifts.
I do, you know. And then I have to say the other thing that for me that's a good interviewee is someone who's in a community that I'm trying to learn, and they start introducing me around or have that desire to show me things or show me people. Those are the perfect ones.
Ben Brantley began his review of Notes from the Field in the New York Times with this sentence: just listen, if you would, to how she listens. Do you think that's your great skill, the ability to listen?
That's a good question, Walter.
Well, Ben Brantley obviously thinks so.
Yeah, I think that's part of it, you know, but it's all connected with listening is connected to speaking and performing and doing. So I think the things are all intertwined, and they all enhance each other over time.
Now, you're caught in kind of a bind in the way that you do what you do. You don't want to be like a Rich Little and just be a mimic. But at the same time, you want to capture a person's essence to the point where if we know that person, we recognize them.
I think now at this stage of the work, and I've been doing this work since the late 70s, I think by now it's really not even that. You know, I have to make a large construct that's going to be on the stage with a variety of people speaking to illuminate a problem, in this case, as you say, the kids in prisons and education in prisons and that relationship. So I work very hard to represent them in a way that if their mother or their father, or in the case of John Lewis, the public goes, wow, that's just how they are. But it's, I would say that's not how, I wouldn't even put myself in the same book as a book on Rich Little. It's not really mimicry. I see it as making portraits of these people for the very specific purpose of telling a larger story.
But they also want to be heard, and because you're going to give them, you're going to give their voice a larger voice.
No, I don't think so. I think all the people who end up in my plays have this kind of gift for communication that I'm talking about. They have a voice. They don't need me to do that. John Lewis, for example, is one of the people in this play. He hardly needs me to do that. Bree Newsom, who climbed the flagpole in Columbia, South Carolina, took down the Confederate flag after the massacre in Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, got a lot of press. It's still getting a lot of press. She doesn't need me.
What is your pipeline project, and why is it called that?
Well, someone, I'm not sure who, one of my interviewees, the now mayor-elect of Stockton, Michael Tubbs, told me that Marion Wright Edelman may have been the person who coined the phrase school-to-prison pipeline. Mm-hmm. But I've have yet to find out who really first said that. But the Department of Justice did release significant data to reveal that Black, Brown, and Native American youths who grow up in poor communities are suspended and expelled more often than middle class kids or kids of better means, and that these suspensions and expulsions, and a certain number of them at a certain time in their lives, does predict that they are going to be incarcerated. So that's where that slogan, the school to prison pipeline, came from, is this awareness that there was a relationship between expulsion, suspension, and incarceration, and that these kids were more likely to be disciplined more harshly for things that may be called mischief at St. Paul's, for God's sake, but or here at Dalton or wherever. But I, after 250 interviews, actually feel it's not correct to call this phenomenon a school-to-prison pipeline. I think it's a poverty-to-prison pipeline, and I think lots of folks are doing work on how several generations of poverty make it almost impossible for a young person to step out. So to blame schools without coming forward and thinking about all the creative ways that we need to help schools and teachers who are always working with few resources intervene with this disease called poverty and all the things that are associated with it, trauma, violence, nihilism.
I remember a report on WNYC about how not just white teachers, but Black teachers as well would treat cut-up behavior as more pathological when the kid was African-American. I guess it's just part of the culture at this point.
I think it is. But again, you know, it doesn't start with the teacher. Some people say it starts in the womb. You know, I talked to a neuroendocrinologist, Bruce McEwen, very world-renowned at Rockefeller University, and one of his colleagues. And, you know, there's studies now about how the stresses affect the coding of DNA, and that this stuff now is really generational. So to me, the point is that the intervention we have to make is pretty magnificent.
You mentioned schools like Dalton. There isn't as big a police presence in those schools as there are in some of the schools you're talking about. Are those police necessary in those schools?
I don't know. You know, there's a private school here in New York that I was doing some work with, wonderful school. I'm not going to name the name because of the story I'm about to tell. But I couldn't resist when I walked in saying to the very nice, attractive African-American woman who was sitting by the door to welcome whoever came in, and I said, no metal detectors. And she looked at me very surprised, very elegant, and she said, you know, that's right. And my children, you know, or Black children, go to school where there's metal detectors. So, no, they're not police. I think to deal with discipline problems, they're probably psychologists, psychiatrists, and coaches, and all kinds of people. And, you know, I don't need to tell you that the other thing is that our schools have been evacuated of stuff like gym and, you know, arts classes and things like that, which are I think, preempt sometimes behavior that's not like the behavior that's called standard and acceptable behavior.
I'm speaking with Anna Deavere Smith, whose latest work, Notes from the Field, is currently at the Second Stage Theater at 305 West 43rd Street, and it will run until December 11th.
Oh, we got extended till the 18th.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah. Thanks.
You portray one teacher in the show, Stephanie Williams, who seemed like a dedicated person with her, who really had her heart in her work. And she said that being a teacher was like running a jail without a gun. What do you think she meant by that?
Boy, I mean, I met so many people like Miss Williams all over this country. I did my research in four geographic areas, Northern California, Baltimore, Philadelphia, and all over South Carolina. People working with very few resources. In the case of Stephanie Williams, she works with children who are special ed, have emotional problems, have problems of coming from poverty, drug addiction, and so forth. And I think what she meant by that was that she's expected to, quote-unquote, control people who are quote unquote out of control for a variety of complicated reasons. And so the metaphor of running a jail without a gun, I think, puts it in a sort of, it's a very stark metaphor.
And she said that she felt as though she was surrounded by starving people and she had nothing to feed them.
Yeah, I think all of these ways that Stephanie, who herself came from very challenging circumstances, but nonetheless ended up going to and graduating from Mount Holyoke, I think that she has an extraordinary imagination, exactly what I'm talking about, the type of person that I'm looking to talk to when you say is a good interviewee, who has a vivid way of expressing a problem. And, you know, when people say my work is about, I'm giving people voice, that's why I think it's ridiculous, because I don't come up with ideas like running a jail without a gun or, starving people and nothing in my hands to give them. I mean, these people are speaking in their own kind of a, if not organic poetry, certainly very riveting and unforgettable language.
And did you find similar feelings in the four different places you went?
Yeah, I ran into this all the time. And everywhere I went, I was left with extraordinary hope because I kept meeting people who were so dedicated in ways that most of us can't even understand.
Didn't you originally call the show Notes from the Field, Doing Time in Education?
Yeah, I did.
Is that how many students and teachers feel that they're doing time?
You know, I got the expression doing time.
I've heard it as a prison term. But
It is a prison time. Yeah, well, I thought that it was an interesting way to think about the notion of school itself as a sort of a incarceration state. I'm sure there are people at Dalton and places like that. I don't mean to pick on Dalton, or even where I have a privilege of teaching NYU, that feel like school is a state, you know, that you have to just get through this, and I'm here for a certain amount of time.
What about your mother? Wasn't she a teacher? Have you talked to her about how she felt when she was teaching?
Well, my mother has passed away in 2003. I dedicated the show to my mother and to Maxine Green. New Yorkers and others will know Maxine Green is a great philosopher of education, very distinguished, was at Teachers College for a long, long time, died at something like 97, 98 years old just a couple of years ago. My mother was a very dedicated teacher. All of her friends were teachers. Almost all of my aunts on both sides were teachers. And so I grew up in a time where people like my mother really made a difference in people's lives, and they moved a whole generation into, you know, like, depending on where you were. So most of my friends' parents were college-educated African-American people who had gone to historically black colleges. So then those friends of mine went and, you know, sort of mixed schools that had been predominantly white. So in every, or I'm sure my mother was responsible for many kids being the first in their family to go to college. So basically they lifted up a community that was in de facto segregation. So she was a very dedicated teacher, and she was a principal, and that was her life.
And you remember her bringing students home to help them.
Yeah, she really...
But you say it's harder now for one person to make a difference.
I think it is harder, because, I think that the problems are ingrained for several generations. They are systemic. There's not the same will, the same gusto of let's help each other. Let's do this together. There is something, I think, about our society, and I feel it in my students now in NYU, who, again, you know, I'm very lucky. They're very, very talented people. They've had a lot of advantages. You know, this sense of this fear of failing, you know, that I didn't even have in college or when I was in the conservatory, you know, this fear of failing. I think we have in our society this punitive, this sort of hovering sense that you will be punished if you don't do well. Forget about doing good. Let's forget about if we should do good, but we must do well.
So you think teachers are less respected now?
Totally. I mean, part of my research, I went to Finland. As you know, you probably know Finland for a while. I think Singapore is now, but Finland for a long time was considered to have the best education in the world. And their teachers are very highly regarded. They think of their work as continued research. They are supported to be that way. So that's what our classrooms need to be. I mean, these places of constant investigation. They don't have special ed. You know, everybody's mixed in. Special ed they see as something that came from a kind of a medical model, like the school for the deaf or the blind. And they don't want to have that kind of a model.
Are they paid better?
I don't know. They are said to have been paid better, but my sense is it's not just about money.
But they also are more homogeneous cultures.
Not now.
Really?
It's changing.
Because I was wondering about whether part of the situation is, in many parts of the country, that middle-class people are sending their kids to private schools, so the schools very much are places where poor kids go.
Yeah, I think that's the case. I mean, I had an extraordinary high school education, and really, frankly, not doing research for the play, but doing press for the play, and people like you asking me questions that have sort of evoked my own memories. I could write a whole play about a success in integration, which was my high school in Baltimore, Western High School. But in some towns like mine, there was white flight, right? So public schools that had been integrated are not going to be anymore. In terms of homogeneity, I do think a place like Finland would be a great study because they are not as homogeneous as they were. And so it would be very interesting to look at how the effect of having people other than Finnish people in their schools, which is the case over time.
They're bringing immigrants in now?
Yeah. So over 10 years, will that cause, you know, more challenges for them that they didn't have before? I think that's a really good question.
My guest is Anna Deavere Smith, and her latest play is Notes from the Field, which is at the Second Stage Theater at 305 West 43rd Street. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Anna Deavere Smith, who is an actor, writer, teacher, and a theatrical innovator. Her latest work, Notes from the Field, is at the Second Stage Theater at 305 West 43rd Street. And you say it's been extended until December
18th. Yeah.
So one more week.
Yeah.
That's because you got great reviews and people are all excited by this. The first person you portray is Sherilyn Eiffel.
Yes.
Not related or related to?
Yes. She's very close. In fact, you know.
To Glenn Eiffel?
I should say. What a loss I feel it is to the United States and the world that Gwen Eiffel died 2 days ago. Hmm. And Sherilyn is her cousin. They're very close, as a matter of fact.
And she is the president of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. How does she see the relationship between prisons and schools?
First of all, we have to say that's another example of someone who's so exquisitely verbal and brilliant in terms of her ability to use language to communicate.
Do you find yourself smiling when they're giving you all of that?
Yeah.
This is going to work really well in the show.
Oh, yeah. I mean, she frames the show. I mean, you know, she tells the audience where they are, and she basically says that you can't talk about mass incarceration or the criminal justice system without talking about education, and points out the ways in which, you know, there was this enormous investment in Brown versus Board of Ed, Thurgood Marshall, certainly a national and international hero, and then very quickly the Prince Edward County School Board closes schools in Virginia rather than integrate. And when I was in South Carolina doing my research, I came upon that a lot, that like right after this was decreed that you must stop segregation, they just made private schools for white people. So that whole that investment, you know, wasn't protected. And she says the major investment we've had of late is the investment in the criminal justice system. But she feels the good news is, at least she did before the election, that the national awareness on both sides of the fence, both Democrats and Republicans, that we're incarcerating too many people is a moment where we have this opportunity to do something else with that money. And, of course, many of us would like that to go to schools.
Well, we hear a lot about underfunding in both cases, but prisons often are a major source of income in small communities.
Absolutely. So that's a conflict. You know, a place like Pennsylvania, I really came upon that to understand that quite a lot. You know, that gives jobs to people who build them.
Immediately after Sherilyn Hill, we see footage of Freddie Gray in Baltimore. Was the Freddie Gray killing the impetus for your thinking about doing this show?
Oh, no, not at all. I started thinking about this in 2011.
I just thought because Baltimore is your hometown.
Yeah, but, well, the fact of Baltimore does factor into this, that a wonderful woman works in philanthropy, Ann Beeson, who was at the time at the Open Society, invited me to come and learn about the school-to-prison pipeline. I had never heard about it. She invited 15 funders from around the country, program officers, and many of the stories I heard were about Baltimore, and one was about a kid who had peed, can I say that word on the air?
Yes.
In a water cooler, and, you know, he was going to be arrested. And I was, now that doesn't seem unlikely to me, but in 2011, when I first heard it, I was stunned. And I was on a television show called Nurse Jackie at the time, next day in hair and makeup, sitting next to a brilliant British actress, Eve Best. I said, wow, I just heard this story about a kid who was arrested for peeing in a water cooler in my hometown. And she said, well, whatever happened to mischief? And that's when I was like, gotta do this project. Poor kids get pathologized and incarcerated and punished, and middle class and rich kids get mischief.
The first part of the show is devoted to Freddie Gray, and there's among the more moving moments is a eulogy of him by Jamal Harrison Bryant. Were you at that funeral?
No, I was not at the funeral. I arrived in Baltimore just a couple of weeks after the riots. Now, the riots broke out on the day of that funeral, but I wasn't at the funeral.
But you did speak with Pastor Bryant.
I did, yeah.
And there are other very striking moments. For instance, when Councilman Michael Tubbs describes how difficult it is to find an apple in his district.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, well, I've certainly...
I mean, I've heard of food deserts, but apples?
Sure, you know, yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. Or if there is an apple, probably a pretty brown one. And by the way, the good news is that Michael Tubbs did win his contest to become mayor of Stockton. He's now mayor-elect.
But how much can a politician do about bringing apples into an area?
I think a lot. And, you know, particularly when I was in Baltimore, like in sort of the rubble of that riot, to talk to a couple of, I was very surprised, African-American politicians who wanted to make community gardens. I said, really? Now, one of my dear, dear friends is Alice Waters, the great restaurateur in Berkeley, who was really at the forefront of this whole idea of, you know, I've also represented her in three of my plays, mm-hmm. where she uses food to me as a metaphor of transformation.
And so, she's convinced schools to actually get the kids growing vegetables
absolutely.
And fruit in the playgrounds.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm on the advisory board of that edible schoolyard project of hers. Brilliant. So, but to, you know, first time I start talking to Alice was in the 90s about this. And to hear, you know, folks talking about this now as a real viable way to bring health into a community is very exciting to me.
Michael Tubbs tells a heartbreaking story about reading to a kindergarten class on Martin Luther King Day. What does he find out?
Well, it's pretty sad, isn't it? As he reads to them about the death of Martin Luther King, and as he says, he's tried to go through the page really quickly because he didn't want to talk to six-year-olds about death, a child raises his hand and eagerly, you know, says, you know, Mr. Tubbs, my uncle got shot. And then, you know, Tubbs thought, what, you know, he said it so matter-of-factly that Tubbs just said, you know, well, I'm so sorry, but I'm glad he's still with us now. And the kid said, oh, no, he died. And then another kid raised his hand and said, you know, Mrs. Tubbs, my cousin got shot. And before he could turn the page, every child in the classroom at 6 years old knew someone who had been shot or killed. So, you know, he's really illustrating for us in a succinct and powerful way of how violence permeates these communities. And that's another reason why I think it's unfair to blame schools and teachers for something that's all around and in and integrated into ways that children live in poverty.
My guest is Anna Deavere Smith. Her latest work is Notes from the Field, which is at the Second Stage Theater at 305 West 43rd Street, running through December 18th. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In previous shows of yours I've seen over the years, it's just been you alone on the stage, often in a simple pair of black pants and a white shirt. But you've incorporated video here and music.
Well, the music was my idea. The video is the brilliance of my director, Leonard Folia. It's really a stunning production, and he had an extraordinary group of designers, a brilliant video designer, Elaine McCarthy, Hal Brinkley, who did the lighting for Hamilton, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful production. Now I'm still in black.
As much success as Hamilton.
Well, not many, right?
You just have to learn how to rap.
I just have to learn how to rap. Still in black pants, a different version of black pants, blue shirt, not a white shirt. But I did start working with a musician, Marcus Shelby, way before I, started working with the director. So I sort of started improvising and working with Marcus long before I had a production in mind.
Does the music feed you something?
I wouldn't say that, but I think that it is a very good, it's a good accompaniment to the project. And, Marcus, as a result of working with me, has now started working in the prisons himself in San Quentin. I think he was just a great artist to start to think with and work with before I knew I was going to actually do a production.
And putting this together, how many people have you interviewed?
250.
And how much winds up in the show?
Just, total of about 2 hours, so 19 people are represented. Or actually, 19 people are represented.
Do you ever consider making the tapes of the shows available elsewhere?
Yes, that is part of
it. Is it online?
Not online, but at this point, but part of the project. The play is a part of a larger project, which I've produced, called the Pipeline Project, and one part of that will be an archive.
And am I correct to assume that each person's section that is in the play is actually verbatim?
Verbatim, yeah.
You don't change anything?
No.
You've said that you traveled to three continents in the process of developing this show.
Three continents? No.
Well,
just to Europe and America in this one. Let Me Down Easy, I went to three continents. But this one, it's a very, very American-based. The only trip I made abroad was to Finland.
And where have you performed the show?
I did it originally. The idea was just to do stage readings and have town halls. So Berkeley, Stockton, up on the Indian Reservation, the Yurok Reservation in Klamath, California, Baltimore, Philadelphia, and we will be going to South Carolina.
The situation's pretty much the same in the Indian reservations as they are in the inner cities?
Really? Significantly worse. I mean, I think that was a life-changing experience for me to spend time on the Yurok Reservation, on the river. The river is the center of their life. They're salmon fishermen. And I've really never seen anything like it in America in terms of poverty, in terms of despair, in terms of violence as a constant in the lives of these extraordinary people. You know, the Yurok are the biggest tribe in the state of California. So it's really been a very powerful experience to be in association with them.
And California is considered a pretty liberal state.
In some ways. I think it depends. Not necessarily.
You are much better known now than when you started doing this work. Does that make it easier for you to get access to people?
Many of the people I talk to have no idea who, quote unquote, I am. So I don't. Whatever that means, who I am, who I am. But the fact that I have been on television doesn't necessarily mean anything to folks. I mean, one of the most important people in the project, Abby Abinante, who's the chief judge of the Yurok tribe, her staff thought it was funny that she'd never heard of me. I don't think I'm famous enough that would be the case.
Well, you're famous enough in the circles I travel in, but I wonder whether you've interviewed some people that you really took a disliking to and yet at the same time felt it was important to tell their stories. How do you work that out?
Well, again, I feel that would be like okay, I mean, this sounds very puffed up of me, but let's just use not a very good metaphor. You probably wouldn't ask a doctor that, you know, like, how do you feel about giving treatment to a person you don't like? And, you know, my work is really not about liking and not liking. It's about studying and trying to understand what that person is saying and how I can greedily gobble that up and apply it to this portrait that I'm trying to make. So I have had people I've talked to who I couldn't get to talk, and maybe you've had similar experiences, but I wouldn't put it in the level of liking or not liking.
You've said Shakespeare is a big influence. Isn't he the opposite to you in terms of language?
No, not at all. And if I hadn't studied way back many, many years ago Shakespeare and how to speak Shakespeare, I could never perform, for example, Alan Bullock, who is a young man I met in Baltimore who went to jail for tearing up a police car. Very complicated language. I could never have learned and performed that language if I hadn't been trained classically.
Do you think theater can create social change?
Yes, I do. I do.
Are you thinking about... I can't imagine that you're not thinking about this election as as material for a future show.
Well, I think if not the election, I think for a lot of artists, I hope that there's a lot of artists out there right now who are making plans on both sides of the fence.
Alec Baldwin sure has got 4 years locked up on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, but, you know, I hope the painters and poets, I'm sure the poets are busily writing away, filmmakers. I'm sure there are a trillion documentary filmmakers are making proposals right now. I think that this will be a time that we will see a surge of art making that is civically oriented and that is about social change. I have an institute at New York University called the Institute on the Arts and Civic Dialogue that I first started at Harvard. And, you know, over the last... 20 years, I've seen a real upsurge, even wherever I go to talk at universities to artists, is many people have been wanting to apply their art to social change and for the benefit of good in the world. So I think this is an extraordinary moment for all of that to come to bear. And I think we're going to see some wonderful art all around us.
You were hired at NYU by John Sexton, who was the dean of the law school at the time. Were you hired to be in the law department?
No, he and the then dean of the School of the Arts, Mary Schmidt Campbell, did conspire together to get me to leave Sanford. John is so special, John Sexton, and he's a visionary. But his idea was that I would be affiliated with the law school, and I did teach there with Peggy Cooper Davis, who was a law professor, and Carol Gilligan. But our goal was to really teach listening and to teach engagement. You know, how do you engage with the people? I think any profession could really use, you know, is how do you engage with the person sitting across from you who you're supposedly going to be serving in some kind of way.
Notes from the Field is at the Second Stage Theater at 305 West 43rd Street until December 18th. It has been my great honor to have Anna Deavere Smith on our show again.
Oh, it's my joy to be with you. I guess that might be a reason to make works, is to be able to come here and see you.
Come back with the next one.
Thank you.
Can't wait.
Thank you.